equips him with four essential qualities, and they are purity of descent, befitting conduct, reputation, and elevation of the people to maturity by his teachings. And it goes on and says, when the people become elevated to maturity, they reciprocate with the Brahman by exhibiting toward him four good qualities: worship, charity, and immunity from domination, and immunity from capital punishment. So maybe I'll explain that a little bit. Purity of descent. So Brahman, when he performs discipline and austerity, and his intelligence becomes elevated, then he develops the brahminical qualities. Purity of descent. Of course, in his previous life, he practices sadhana, and then he takes a good birth. So, although we preach that birth is not essential, but still, if you're born in a good Brahmin family, that's a great advantage. So many great Brahmins were born in Brahmin families. We're living in a mixed up world. So, we're picking Brahmins out of the gutter. But the normal system is you're born in a proper Brahmin family, you get a good background and training. So someone who for many lifetimes practices to be a Brahmin, he'll take a good Brahmin birth. That's the first quality you earn by your sadhana, to practice to be a Brahmin. Second, befitting conduct. Krishna says, Chaturvarna maya shrishtam guna karma vibhagasha. The four divisions of society, varnas, are distinguished by guna and karma, not primarily birth. Birth is secondary. Primary distinction, criterion of who's a Brahmin, who's a Shudra, is what's their character and how do they behave. Now you can have a brahminical character, you can be smart and be religiously inclined, but if your training is not good and your habits aren't good, then you're not really a Brahmin. You're not a Brahmin by birth, even if you've got the potential. You have to be trained up and you have to live up to the standard. You have to take advantage of your training to become a real Brahmin. But one who performs the proper sadhana, maybe in many lifetimes, he also comes to that standard of proper behavior. And what's proper behavior for a Brahmin? The standards are very strict. He has to, just like we have our four regular principles, that's minimum. In the Dharma Shastras, there's hundreds of regular principles, enough to make your head spin. And the Brahmins are meant to obey all these rules and regulations. They behave very properly. Krishna says in the Gita, Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te, Karya Karya Vivastitao, Tasmat Shastra Vidana Uktam, Karma Kartam Iharasi. You should be a Paka Brahmin, Arjuna. You should do everything you do on the basis of the Shastric injunctions. Before you decide to do anything or not to do anything, what to do and what not to do, you consult the Shastra. And don't do anything whimsically. That's brahminical behavior. You think, what does the Shastra want me to do or not do before you do anything? That's proper behavior. And then reputation. So what's the Brahmin's reputation based on? A king's reputation is based on what he's conquered and how he controls, and his charisma. He gives out lots of charity and everybody loves him for that. But a Brahmin is not, doesn't get a reputation for how much money he spends or how he controls people. His reputation is the trustworthiness of his word. A Brahmin is respected and he's influential because people trust what he says. They believe what he says. They know this person only speaks the truth and he knows what he's talking about. That's a reputation of a Brahmin. That's much more important than a reputation of a Kshatriya. That's the basis of Vedic society. When you have people whose word can be trusted, then you can have a peaceful, progressive society. Without that, everything's chaos. So the reputation of the Brahmins, based on the trustworthiness of what they say, is the most important foundation of the whole Vedic social system. And traditionally, when you grow up in that system, you trust the Brahmins because they supported you and gave you guidance from your very birth. You know, your Brahmins taught your mother and father how to conceive you, how to have you as a child, how to raise you, and then the Brahmins taught you from the first day in school, you know, up to the day you died, your Brahmins guided you and taught you how to live your life properly. Therefore you trust them. Not just because it says so in some book, or somebody says you gotta, you know, obey the Brahmins or they'll curse you. No, because they actually took care of you your whole life, and therefore you trust them. Therefore, to establish the system is not an overnight thing. You have to establish the trust over generations. That's the reputation. That's the second important quality that one who becomes a Brahmin acquires, is influence by the purity and trustworthiness of his word. An elevation of the pure. Oh, that was the third one. Purity of descent, befitting conduct. Third was reputation. Fourth was elevation of people to maturity by his teaching. He has knowledge. He doesn't keep it to himself. He uses it to benefit the rest of society. Like we said yesterday, what distinguishes the Brahmins and Kshatriyas from the two lower classes is that they're selfless servants of the rest of society. They're not selfish. They're working to benefit everybody. So they have knowledge and they teach that knowledge in order to elevate everybody. And because their word is trusted and they have something, they know what they're talking about, therefore they actually can accomplish that. They can raise consciousness and the behavior of the whole society. Okay, then when people get that benefit of Brahminical guidance, they reciprocate. They treat the Brahmins with respect. And the four qualities of respect they show: worship, you know, a Brahmin should be honored. He shouldn't be treated like an ordinary person. He should be offered, and then second, he should be offered charity. He should just support the Brahmins. They shouldn't have to work for a living. They shouldn't have to hustle to survive. In a society that's at all civilized, the proper Brahmins are maintained by charity. They don't even have to ask for it. When that's lacking, how can the Brahmins function as Brahmins? Nobody's going to give them charity. They have to go out and work like everybody else. How can they act like Brahmins then? So it's necessary that the social system be established to give support for the prosecution of spiritual life. And then in relationship to the government, immunity from domination. That means the king is ruling everybody, but he doesn't try to rule the Brahmins. He gives the Brahmins their autonomy and leaves them alone as much as possible. Now the Brahmins, they know how to live their own life. They don't have to be dominated by the government. And certainly, the last thing is immunity from capital punishment. You don't kill a Brahmin. Ashwatthama committed a heinous crime. It was wartime, but he shouldn't have had to done that. He shouldn't have murdered these children of the Pandavas in their sleep. Even Duryodhana thought it was disgusting. And Krishna told Arjuna captured Ashwatthama. Because after that, Ashwatthama tried to kill the Pandavas and then using his Brahmastra weapon, but he did not know how to withdraw. He tried to kill the Pandavas and Uttara with Pariksit, the last Pandava, the last Kuru heir, in her womb, not even born. Not enough that he killed these children. He has to kill the unborn child, who is the womb of Uttara also. So they caught him before, you know, they stopped him from doing this. Krishna stopped him. And Arjuna captured Ashwatthama, and Krishna told him, kill him! Without any consideration. Kill him immediately for what he's done. Unacceptable, intolerable what he did. But still, Krishna, Arjuna said, okay, well, let's bring him to the camp. I promised Draupadi that she could take her bath after mourning her son standing on his head. So I had to bring him to Draupadi first. So Krishna, even though Arjuna told him to kill, he brought Ashwatthama back to the camp. And Draupadi didn't want to kill him. He said, look, this is the son of our guru. Now, I don't want Kripi, Dronacharya's wife, widow, to be lamenting like I'm lamenting now for my children. So don't kill him. He's a Brahmin. A Brahmin is always worshipable. No matter what they've done, you don't kill a Brahmin. So Krishna said, and then Bhima, he said, no, kill him. You know, Bhima came in. So everybody gives a different opinion. And then Krishna wanted to show how intelligent Arjuna is. Okay, Arjuna, you have to satisfy all of us. I said kill, Bhima said kill, Draupadi said don't kill. Yudhishthira, he's just going along with Draupadi. You satisfy everybody and also satisfy the Vedic injunctions. Do the right thing, you figure out what to do. So Arjuna thought for 1 minute, and he took his sword and he cut the jewel off the head of Ashwatthama. He was born with a jewel on his head, and cut half of his hair off and kicked him out of the camp, disrespectfully, like some dog. And that was right, that he made the right choice. This is the appropriate capital punishment for a member of a Brahmin family. You don't kill him physically, but by depriving him of his wealth and shamefully cutting off his hair and exiling him, that's the proper punishment for a Brahmin who otherwise would have to be killed. You don't kill a Brahmin. So the Brahmins are exempt from capital punishment, no matter what they do, if they're proper Brahmins. Okay, any comments? Sure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Normally not, but in emergency situations they can. A Brahmin should simply do his brahminical work. Worship, sacrifice, teach, give charity and accept charity. But if they can't maintain themselves just by that, then in emergencies they can do the work of a kshatriya, which normally means to become a landlord. But they could even fight if they have to. Now, at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, the situation of the world was very abnormal. The whole world was out of balance. Too many powerful kings. Atheism was prominent. The mode of passion was way out of control. And so you have unusual things happening, like Brahmins being born with kshatriya qualities, like Dronacharya. He's born in a sage's family, but he really, from his birth, he was attracted to military science. This was his nature. So he became a great expert in military. He was a Brahmin, but he became a warrior. It's unusual, but in exceptional circumstances it's possible. A Brahmin can do the work of a kshatriya in unusual circumstances. Other way? Well, kshatriyas share some of the activities of the Brahmins. They also study the Vedas. They also perform sacrifices. But a kshatriya should not accept charity. Brahmins can do that. And they shouldn't be teachers of the Vedas. They study the Vedas, but they're not the teachers. So there's some overlapping, but there's still things that only Brahmins do.
Why they shouldn't be teachers of the Vedas?
Because that's the teaching is the privileged function of the Brahmins.
They can
give instruction. Yeah, just like King Janaka, engaged in debate with great rishis. Yeah, but they don't become the gurus. Yeah, they don't become, that's not their occupation. They can engage in philosophical discussion, but they're not the official teachers. Yes. Yes. That's in the Dharma Shastras, yes. Out of the six, there are three that they have to do. Which are? Well, in a university, in a graduate department, there may be 150 graduate students. How many of them are going to become professors? Maybe 5 out of 150. So not every good student is qualified to be a first-class teacher. So therefore, not all Brahmins become teachers. Some of them are just mediocre. Yeah, they can do some sacrifices, a little bit, but they're not up to the standard of being a big teacher. Some Brahmins are teachers, not all of them. Some of them are just, pujaris or something.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't have to take charity. They can just distribute to everybody. All the other classes are below them, so they can give to everybody. But the highest charity is to give knowledge. To teach is the highest act of charity. That's first class charity. Give money is second rate. But a Brahmin shouldn't keep more than he can use immediately. If he gets an excess, he shouldn't put it in the bank. It says that a first-class Brahmin doesn't keep more than he can use in 1 day.
doesn't keep food in the refrigerator or anything. So if he has an excess, he has to give it away immediately. Somebody, anybody. You know, another first-class Brahmin is the best choice, but at least get rid of it somehow. Yes. That's a good idea. Go ahead. No, the best charity is to qualify Brahmin. But just like, if you're distributing prasadam, we're not going to give prasadam only to the Brahmins. We'll give prasadam to everybody, even the cats and dogs. So there's certain kinds of charity that's appropriate to give to everybody, especially distribution of prasadam to everybody. And basic knowledge, we should give to everybody. We give the Mahamantra to everybody. Esoteric, you know, the confidential information about, you know, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, we don't give that to everybody. We give that to qualified people. But there's certain things we give to everybody. Yes,
sir.
Yes. Yeah, there. Yes. Yes. The three compulsory activities, those are his basic duties. The other three are the ways that he keeps himself, keeps his family fed. Yeah. But it's also, the other three are also his contribution to society. I got a few minutes. I wanted to go back to Kartika Muni. He's pretty well finished up his prayers, at least make an attempt at it. Let's look at text 17. Well, in the rest of his prayers, he's sort of shifting. He was talking about himself as a material, you know, sort of trying to present himself as a materialist in the first few verses. You know, people who come to you, O Lord, with material desires, they're real fools, and I'm one of those fools. But he sort of contradicts himself in the rest of his prayers. He reveals his actual very deep Krishna conscious understanding. Now, he's not the materialist he pretends to be. He actually is quite a Vaishnava. And we'll see that in these five verses of the rest of his prayers. So, therefore, what we see in these prayers is not so much the quality of a Brahmin, but on a different level, the quality of a Vaishnava. Text 17. Lokams cha lokanugatan pashums cha vidvashvitaste charanatta patram parasparam twad gunavaru sidhu piyusha niryapita deha dharmaha. However, and he was just talking about foolish people, you know, who go to you for material benefits. And then he says, on the other hand, however, persons who have given up stereotyped worldly affairs and the beastly followers of those affairs, and who have taken shelter of the umbrella of your lotus feet by drinking the intoxicating nectar of your qualities and activities in discussions with one another, can be freed from the primary necessities of this material body. What is he talking about here? He's talking about Harinam Sankirtan. Yeah. Not only is he shifting to the topic of revelation of his understanding of devotional service, he's jumping right to the essential, most intimate aspect of devotional service, the hearing and chanting the glories of the personality of Godhead in the association of pure devotees. That is Sankirtan. Yes, I'm sorry? Krishna Katha, yes. But especially Krishna Katha together with other devotees. It's kirtan, but that's some kirtan. Congregational chanting. So, he's discussing here, Kartava, how one becomes free from all these bodily necessities by taking shelter of the Supreme Person's lotus feet, by devotional service. We have our embarrassing situation. We're in this world of material desires. But if we take shelter of the Lord, especially by performance of devotional service, and especially by Shravanam Kirtanam, by that form of devotional service, we'll become free from all this embarrassing entanglement. By drinking the nectar, piyusha, piyusha means liquor, intoxicating beverage, of topics, discussions of your qualities, your transcendental spiritual qualities, we'll forget material intoxication by a higher intoxication. Like Narottam Das Thakur prays, Vishaya Vashana Mul Kodhi Tucho Holi. By remembering the glories of Radha and Krishna, the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, their senses and minds are still active. They're not, you know, impersonalists who are trying to shut down their senses. They're engaging their senses very actively in devotional service. But because their senses are filled with the glories of Radha and Krishna, their material urges, even though they're still there, become insignificant. You don't even notice that your senses are making so many demands in your mind. You can't, you have no time to pay attention to them. So, tuchaholi, the urges of the senses and the mind become insignificant. That's the stage of advanced devotional service, absorption in harikatha. Give up lokan and lok anugatan pashun. Give up this material world and all its foolishness, and especially the animalistic people who populate this world. Now, not to insult anybody, but from the transcendental point of view, most of the people in this world are living like animals. And therefore, why indulge in the association of animals unless you want to be an animal? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was talking to Raghunath Das, when Raghunath Das managed finally to escape from his parents, and his parents, what was his name? Hiranya Majumdar, Govardhan Majumdar was his uncle. Very prominent Vaishnavas of Bengal, zamindars, rich landowners, but also very famous as very religious Vaishnavas. Haridas Thakur visited them and was agreed to speak in their assembly. So they were reputable Vaishnavas. And if Haridas Thakur comes to your house, you must be a decent person. But Lord Chaitanya said, you know what I really think of your father and uncle? I think they're like worms in the stool, in the cesspool. Nice. Because they're just, you know, they think they have the reputation of Vaishnavas, but they're addicted to sense gratification. So from the transcendental point of view, most of the people in this world are two-legged animals. Yeah. So that's what Kautam is saying. Give up this world and all the animals that populate it. So Kautam himself admitted that he has the desire to get married, to get a wife. These are just bodily needs. If you have such bodily desires, you have to follow the Vedic regulations if you want to remain a civilized person. If you can't give up material desires but you want to be a civilized person, you have to follow the Vedas. If you become a pure devotee, then you can ignore the Vedic regulations. But first of all, you have to become fully Krishna conscious. Otherwise, if you still have material desires, you're going to have to follow the rules and regulations of the social system. Tavat karma, Krishna, we quoted this yesterday, Krishna says to Uddhava, Tavat karmani kurivita na nirvidyeta yavata mat kata shravanadalva yavat shradana jayate. You have to continue doing your Vedic duty, varnashram duty, until you actually give up your interest in it. Okay, when you have no more desire for material things, okay, then you can forget the rules and regulations of the varnashram system. When you're free completely from material desire. Or in other words, what that also means, until you become very attracted to hearing and chanting my glories. Means the same thing. Giving up material desires means it's only accomplished by becoming attracted to Harikatha. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about, he uses the phrase, stereotyped worldly affairs. I had to find that here. Anyway, I don't have time to. Second line, yeah. Kautama Muni asserts that marriage and other social affairs are stereotyped regulations for persons who are addicted to material sense enjoyment. Prabhupada uses very interesting language. Prabhupada studied English in the old school, Scottish Church College, Calcutta. Studied English literature from the 19th century and older English literature. So he uses language we're not familiar with. A very, very graphic language. Stereotype means hackneyed, you know, overused. You know, people just do the same thing over and over again. 10 million lifetimes after another, you pursue sense gratification. The same old sense gratification in different forms. You can drink your milk out of a clay cup or a gold cup, but it's the same thing you're drinking. Same sense gratification. Life after life. Stereotype. Same thing over and over again. That's material life. But what's this word stereotype? What's the history of it? Anybody know what the word actually means? a stereotype? Yeah, but it has a history. Okay, back in the 19th century, you know, when they first were printing books, go back to the 16th, 15th century, the invention was, you know, the language has 50 letters, 48 letters. English language has only 26 letters in English language. So instead of carve out the whole page of the Bible, you know, make a carving of the whole book and print that, why don't you just make 26 different letters and stick them together and make a page like that? Then you just have to have a lot of little letters and pick them out and make a page. So for 300 or 400 years, that's how they printed books. They'd have a box with hundreds of thousands of different little letters, and the little boy would pick them out and assemble the page. But then they figured, well, look, you know, we have to, you know, do this over and over again. Somebody invented what was called a stereotype. You take a page made up of all these little letters, and you put papier-mâché over it, and you make an impression like a mold. And you use that papier-mâché mold to make another mold made out of metal, which has the shape of all the letters in one piece. Not all these little pieces, but one piece, and that's permanent. That's called a stereotype. Now, stereo means three-dimensional. So it's a three-dimensional mold built on top of the original box of little letters. That's the invention. Somebody invented it and called it a stereotype. So a stereotype is something you use to make an impression of the same thing over and over and over again. And so therefore, the idea of the word became something that's just overused. Anyway, a lot of the phrases Prabhupada used had these quaint histories. But, okay, that's verse 17. Let's look at verse 18. Nate jaraksha bhamir ayuresham trishodasharam trishatam shashti parva shanni mananta chariyat trinabi karala sroto jagat achid yatavat. Your wheel, which has three naves. Naves are, you know, wheel has a center, like this, what do you call it? Spokes coming out on the outside of the wheel. The naves are the three parts of that inner circle. Those are naves. Am I right? Okay. Rotates around the axis of the axis of the wheel, making the two wheels, of the imperishable Brahman. It has 13 spokes, 360 joints going around the wheel. Six rims. So a rim and then another rim and six of them. And numberless leaves carved upon it, just decorations. Through its revolution, though its revolution cuts short the lifespan of the entire creation, this wheel of tremendous velocity cannot touch the lifespan of the devotees of the Lord. This is just a symbolic description of time. Time cannot touch the lifespan of the devotees of the Lord. Because their bodies die, but they gain eternal life. Those who practice the pure devotional service. Otherwise, everybody else, their life is cut short by time. And time has various divisions. So three waves, three, you know, divisions of that inner wheel. Those are the three seasons, the three, 4 month divisions of the year. Chaturmasya? Chaturmasya is the rainy season, 4 months. But there's four times 3 months in the whole year, 12 months. So there's four. There's three Chaturmasyas. Those are the basic divisions. Then also you can divide the year up into six parts. In India, those are the six seasons. 13 months. Yeah, there's, you know, we count 12 months, but every few years there's a leap month, so there's a 13th month also. 360 days, and the minutes or the moments are countless. There's so many you can't even count them. Those are the divisions of time. And this time rotates around Brahman. In other words, time is the energy of the Supreme, the Eternal Supreme. The Supreme is unchanging and eternal. But he controls the material creation by the divisions of time. There's a statement in the second canto, the first canto of the Bhagavatam. Ayur hadati vai pumsam ujjan astan chayanasau tasyarte yat kshano nito uttamashloka lilaya. The sun is taking away the life span of every person. Every time the sun rises and sets, everybody's a day closer to death. With the exception of those persons who spend all their time in the hearing and chanting of the glories of the Supreme Person. The Son and the Moon, the Son doesn't take their life away. That's verse 18. Yes, I'm sorry. Six rims. Those are the six seasons. You know, in India, we don't have four seasons, we have six, each 2 months long. It works like that. You know, we're used in the West that everything follows the solar calendar. You know, when the winter equinox comes, and it's the shortest day of the year, you know, it's cold days in January always. But in India, it works differently. The Santa Panchami, the first day of spring, comes on a different day in the solar calendar every year. This year was January 29th. But it always works out, at least in Braj, that it starts getting warm on the Santa Panchami. And then when Shivaratri comes, then it's really warm. It always follows somehow in India, or at least in the Holy Dham, the lunar calendar actually establishes the seasons. Okay, text 19. No, we're out of time. Let's stop here. Any final comments? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, I mean, a devotee also gets sick and gets old and dies, but he's disconnecting himself from the bodily connection, from the bodily attachments. It doesn't matter to him that his body is going to die, or that all his money is going to be taken away from him, or he has to give up his family. He doesn't even identify with them anymore. So for him, he doesn't lose anything. He's gained his treasure in the eternal world, and time can't take that away. That's all. His body's going to die, but it's not his body anymore. He's already given it up even before he leaves it. Okay? And thank you all very much, Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay. As you go out, you can take, this is the second installment.
We want to understand God. We even want to understand our relationship with God and our duty to serve God, but for the purpose of becoming liberated. So anyway, verse 19 we'll look at right now. Text 19.
Ekat swayam sany jagatat sushrikshaya advitiyayatman Ariyoga Mayaya Svijasya Dattasi Punar Grahishyasi Grahishyase Yatturna Nabhir Bhagavan Swashakti Bihi.
Translation. My dear Lord, you alone create the universes, O Personality of Godhead. Desiring to create these universes, you create them, maintain them, and again wind them up by your own energies, which are under the control of your second energy called Yogamaya. Just as a spider creates a cobweb by its own energy and again winds it up. So Ekaha. Prabhupada says in the purport, there are two words in this verse that particularly nullify the impersonal conception. Ekaha and Yoga Mayaya. First of all, Ekaha. The Supreme Person, he alone is the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. He's supreme, absolute, complete person. He has within himself all the potencies to create everything, to maintain it and to destroy it. But it's not that he depletes himself, that by expanding himself he becomes something less. In other theistic conceptions, they have difficulty understanding how God can expand himself, how he can become, he's one. How can he become many without becoming imperfect? God is perfect. So like the Mayavadis, you know, the Supreme is perfect, undivided, formless. How can he be a person and still be perfect? So even in the Western world, the early Christians, following the Greek philosophy of the Neoplatonists, they try to understand, you know, make a theology, explanation of who is God. And they pretty much came up with a Mayavadi explanation. God is originally undivided. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't have a personality. Or he doesn't reveal his personality. Certainly he doesn't do anything. So how is the work of creation done if God doesn't do anything? So they come up with a conception of something called a demiurge, a second person, sort of a shadow of God. This demiurge, this demigod, does the actual creation. That creator person, whoever he is, he's not perfect, because if you're doing something, you're not perfect. God is just sitting in his rocking chair, not doing anything. Anyway, they just can't grasp the idea how the Supreme can act, especially how he can expand out of himself all the dualities and all the imperfection of material creation without making himself imperfect. So that has to be, it's explained in the Upanishads. But still, even after looking at the Upanishads, no one can understand it properly without the Vaishnav insight. With the blessings of a pure devotee, you can understand this mystery. Otherwise, you can study all the Vedas, all the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra, backwards and forwards, for lifetimes, and you won't understand. It will still remain confusing. But here, in Bhagavatam, it's being presented. If we study the Bhagavatam with the guidance of the pure devotees, we'll understand. Here's two words, ekaha. Okay, all by himself he does this creation. All by himself, but there is this yogamaya. So, you know, we have a demiurge in our philosophy. You know, we can consider Lord Brahma the secondary creator. But he's just a jiva. He's just an engineer. You know, the engineers are somebody you hire. We're going to build this huge temple on the order of Srila Prabhupada, do the wonder of the world. But, you know, we'll hire some company to come and be the construction agent, you know, the engineer. It's just somebody you hire. So Brahma is just the engineer of the universe. But the real agent, the real first-hand assistant of the Supreme is the Yogamaya, his creative potency, his creative energies. The one Supreme Person can expand himself unlimitedly, even into imperfection, even make himself, you know, make his energies limited and imperfect, without diminishing himself, without becoming anything less than what he is, by having his energies do the work for him. Especially, first of all, his creative energy, Yogamaya. Of course, the material energy is simply just a shadow or an expansion of his internal pleasure potency. So actually the original creative energy is Krishna's own internal his consort. For the work of creating the material world, she expands into material nature. So that one person, through the agency of his personal energy, he creates everything without becoming anything, becoming contaminated himself. Prabhupada points out that the other thing that we should see from this description is that the Lord is conscious. Prabhupada uses the word sentient. He's conscious. And he's all-powerful. So therefore, he's capable, Prabhupada says, of hearing his devotees' prayers. Pardama is convinced of that because the Lord has come personally. No doubt about it for Pardama, that Krishna can hear his devotees' prayers, and he does choose to answer. The Lord's transcendental existence is Satchidananda. He has a body, and that body is purely spiritual. Okay, let me read the next verse. We begin discussing, giving the answer, why. Why does the Lord create the material world? Text 20. Tad Batadisha Padam Tavip Sitam Yan Maya Yanas Tanushe Puta Sukhsmam Anubrahayast Api Yarhi Maya Yadat
tulasya bhagavan vilapshitaha. My dear Lord, although it is not your desire, you manifest this creation of gross and subtle elements just for our sensual satisfaction. Let your causeless mercy be upon us, for you have appeared before us in your eternal form, adorned with a splendid wreath of tulsi leaves. So the Lord remains in his personal glory. He doesn't become impersonal by expanding into the inert material creation. He's there, worshipped by tulsi, embraced by his internal potency. And he doesn't create the world because he wants to, although that's sometimes said like that. Sa'aikshata loka nusrija. In the Aitareya Upanishad, the Lord glanced and he thought, let me create progeny, let me create worlds. So it sounds like God wanted to create something. He was bored or he was lonely and he wanted to make something to play with. But here it's explained, that's only a superficial perception. He's expressing a desire, but it's not really his own desire. God wants to create the world only because we want the world, and he wants to give us what we want. He's a benevolent father, fulfilling the whims of the child, the children. That's explained here. O Lord, Kardama addresses Lord Narayan, you don't want this creation, but you created for us because we want sense gratification. We want to enjoy, not by gratifying your senses, we want to try letting ourselves be the object of gratification instead. We want to be the enjoyers and controllers. So you kindly give us a separate world in which we can try to do that, to fulfill our desires. The Lord has no business with material creation. He's just doing it because the rebellious souls are insisting on it. And Prabhupada discusses in the purport that similarly, the Lord's pure devotees also have no business with the material creation. It's a terrible, fearful place. Padam, yadipadam natesham. It's a place where there's danger and embarrassment at every step. Therefore, it's not a proper place. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave the example of a toilet. Yeah. It's not a fit place for a gentleman to loiter. You go in there, do your business, and get out. Here's Kardama. He's got some business. I've got to go to the toilet. So I have some business I have to do. I don't sit in the toilet for hours admiring the architecture. I do my business and get out. Kardama is in this world, but he intends to do his business and get out as quickly as possible. Okay, here's a question. What excuse do devotees have for remaining in this world? What can we do here that justifies our remaining here? Okay, I can think of one other thing. Preaching is the most useful thing to do. One other thing that I can think of. I'll help the Lord kill demons. There's only two things that the Supreme Lord and his agents can do here that they can't do in the spiritual world. There's no scope for preaching where they can encourage each other in devotional service, but there's no conditioned souls to preach to in the spiritual world. So if you want to really preach, you have to come here. The other is, you want to kill demons. There's no actual demons in the spiritual world. In Goloka, everybody's worried that Keshi is going to come and attack, but he never comes. Sometimes it's described, they're just like cardboard figures of the demons up there, but the real demons never come. So when the Lord wants to fight with enemies, when the devotees want to help him destroy his enemies, they have to come to the material world. So those two things are the only excuse, justification a devotee has for remaining in the world. You're either going to help the Lord kill demons, or you're going to help him preach. Otherwise, get out. Kardama, hasn't taken birth in the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra, where he can join the monkey army, or the time of Kalki Avatar. He's in Satyuga, there aren't many demons to kill. And he has not been empowered to do so much preaching himself. He's going to give birth to a preacher. And then he goes to take sannyas and go back to Godhead. That's his business. So that's his devotional service. It's Krishna's decision ultimately. It's Krishna's choice for a devotee, what the devotee is supposed to do. If he wants you to preach, then he puts you in a position for preaching. If he wants you to do something else as his service, then he arranges that. Devotees, let Krishna make the arrangements. But anyway, although Kardama, he's preaching here in his prayers. Yeah, a few verses only, but that's his preaching career. And he's preaching to Lord Vishnu, but at least we hear it. So Prabhupada also discusses in the purport how the Lord mercifully shows, it says in the verse, the Lord mercifully shows his personal form in this world. Or, Prabhupada says in the purport, he sends a reliable sangha, or servant, or a reliable author, like Vyasadeva, to give instructions. So, most of, you know, Krishna describes why he takes birth in the fourth chapter of the Gita, Paricharanaya Sadhunam, Vina Shaya Chaduskritam, Dharma Samstarpanartaya, Sambhavani Yuge Yuge. In order to, Krishna comes periodically to this world, comes down in his incarnate avatars to deliver the devotees, to destroy the demons, and to reestablish principles of religion. Three purposes. But actually, can't all those three purposes be done indirectly by somebody else? Krishna can arrange for the material energy to kill demons. Just, you know, some flood or famine or war, dispose of millions of demons at a time. Unwanted population can be removed without, you know, by Krishna, just without lifting a finger. Why does he have to come here for that? Of course, he likes to play. He likes to come and have the sport of fighting with big demons. But he doesn't have to do it himself. So, in the same way, to save the devotees from demoniac interference, danger, he can also arrange for some saintly devotee to become a great king and dispose of all the unruly elements. Krishna doesn't have to do it himself. He can deputize, empower anybody else to do it.
But mercifully, the real essential purpose is hinted at. Paricharanaya Sadhunam, to deliver his devotees. But the devotees don't have any material problems. They're not afraid of, real devotees are not afraid of some demon coming and destroying them. They don't, real devotees don't have any enemies or anything to be afraid of. They trust that Krishna will protect them. But they cannot tolerate separation from him. That they can't see him is the greatest calamity. So he delivers them from that calamity by showing himself. That's how, actually, it's explained by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, that's what it means the Lord delivers his devotees, Paritranaya Sadhanam. He delivers them from the anxiety of not being able to see him by showing himself. So that's the prime purpose why the Lord appears in this world, makes his incarnations. Another reason connected to that is that, okay, Vyasadeva and other sages can present the Vedic literature. But what does Vyasadeva describe in the Bhagavatam? Krishna's incarnations. What would he have to talk about if Krishna never had any incarnations? If the Supreme Lord doesn't personally come himself, he can do everything else indirectly. But if he doesn't come himself, no one will have a definite idea what God is, of how God is a person. All the philosophers and all the sages will be left to speculate and guess what God is. So to remove all this guesswork, God has to come himself and say, here I am, this is what I am. These are my leelas, this is my personality. So in order to remove all the doubt among the philosophers about what is God, God has to show himself. So that's how he establishes the principles of religion, actually. By revealing himself so that great sages like Vyasadeva can record what they saw and what they heard about when the Lord personally appeared. So the Lord himself is involved in this propaganda work. Prabhupada talks about propaganda work to convince the misguided living entities to come back and surrender. So the Lord himself initiates this propaganda work to reclaim the wayward souls. And then he empowers and inspires his servants to carry on this work, this preaching work. Krishna advises in the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharman Parityaja Mami Kam Sharanam Vraja. Just give up all your business in this world. Put everything aside, what you think your responsibilities and duties are, and just surrender to me, become my servant, full-time servant, and trust fully in me, and I'll deliver you. So Kardama has a good idea of this. He has a good conception. He understands why. He's not a fool. Kardama understands, and very few people do understand properly, why God created this world, why he comes to this world personally, what the business of God is. We're servants of God, so we should understand what is the business of our master, because we're supposed to be helping him in his business. So Kardama understands. This makes him, that marks him as a good servant. He's a very good devotee. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yes. He's even more eligible. He's, you know, this makes him eligible to become Father of God. Yeah. That he has that not just sentiment, but he has tattvagyan, scientific understanding. Janma karma chame divyam. This is the point you're just making. Janma karma chame divyam. One who understands, Krishna says, how I'm born and how I act and my birth and activities are special. One who understands that doesn't have to take birth again. He comes back to me. He's liberated. But he doesn't say just liberated, merged into the Supreme, but he just comes back to me. Mamiti. So understanding God's birth and activities is qualification not just for liberation, but for re-entrance into pure devotional service. Okay. We can look at text 21. And then there's three more verses of his prayers.
Tam tvanu bhutyo parata kriyar tam swamayaya vartita lokatantram namamya bhikshnam namaniya para sarujam alpiyasi kama varsham.
I continuously offer my respectful obeisances unto your lotus feet, of which it is worthy to take shelter, because you shower all benedictions on the insignificant. To give all living entities detachment from fruitive activity by realizing you, you have expanded these material worlds by your own energy. So, the Supreme Person creates this world. You can say he creates it to give us facility to try to enjoy separately. But his higher purpose is to teach us detachment and give us the opportunity to detach ourselves from the entanglement by realizing him. Okay, go in the world, try to enjoy, make a fool of yourself. But I intend that you come back to me, and I will give you facility for that. That's his ultimate purpose. So Kardama is very grateful. He's bowing down and offering his thanks, especially since he considers himself one of these very insignificant, foolish persons who have rebelled against him, the Supreme Person. So he's so grateful. You are showering. It's like the rain pours down, both on the fertile field and on the dry rocks also. The Lord's mercy pours down on those who deserve it and also those who don't. So he's very thankful. Even though I, Kardama, don't deserve your mercy, still you're showering me with it. I'm such an insignificant person. I've disqualified myself by rebelling against you, and still you're doing everything to bring me back. Prabhupada makes the very important point in the purport. This shows that everybody should offer obeisances to the Supreme Lord, whether he's free from desires or full of desires. Still he should approach the Supreme Lord for the fulfillment of his desires. Certainly the all-powerful personality of Godhead is capable of fulfilling everybody's desires, and he's willing to do that. Akama sara kamo va moksha kamo udaradi. If someone is smart, whether he's got all sorts of material desires, or whether he wants liberation, or whether he doesn't want anything in particular, just wants to surrender, he should approach the Supreme Lord and try to serve him enthusiastically with intense devotional service. Whatever his motive is, he'll get what he wants best and most quickly by trying to serve the Supreme Person. Anyway, for those who can't understand that, the Vedas provide alternative methods for approaching perfection. Karmakanda and Gyanakanda processes. For most people who are really foolish and think that this world is for their, is really the place that they're supposed to remain and to try to enjoy and succeed, the Karmakanda rituals of the Vedas give them opportunities to try to achieve material success, whatever their idea of success is. Whether they're so foolish they just want a lot of money, or whether they just want a good wife, or good reputation, or they want to go to a higher planet. Whatever they want, the Vedas, through their rituals, offer the opportunity to achieve those ambitions. And at the same time, make an offering to the Supreme Lord. That's Karmakanda. The Gyanakanda is there who've seen the illusion of this, and now they want liberation. They want out of this trap. So the Gyanakanda is there, especially in the Upanishads. How to understand the absolute truth and merge back into that absolute truth. Prabhupada makes the point, liberation is for one who is disgusted with material enjoyment. Atato Brahmagyasa, first statement, first declaration of the Vedanta Sutra. Now, let's inquire into the absolute truth. Now that we've tried to enjoy this world, the commentators, Baladeva Vidyabhushan and the earlier commentators like, I think even Shankaracharya, and then Ramanujacharya, quote the same verse also from one of the Upanishads. Pariksha Lokan, Karma Chitan, Nirveda Mayat, Nastya Kritak Pritena. After seeing, wandering around these worlds and seeing how everything you can achieve by karmic endeavors is just temporary and limited, one should give up his interest, become disinterested in all this material endeavor. Nasti akritak kritena. You can't achieve the eternal world that is not created by material work that is just something materially created. What is created can't help you achieve what is not created. In other words, material work won't help you achieve the eternal kingdom of God. And anybody know the second half of the verse? Actually, everybody knows the second half of the verse. Tad vigyan artham sagurum eva vigachet samitpani shrotriyam pramanishtam. That's the second half of that. It's just like from the Mundaka Upanishad. In order to understand how everything in this world is just temporary, that you can't achieve perfection by these imperfect means, by this Karmakanda or Gyanakanda. Therefore, to understand the higher truth, one has to approach a transcendental spiritual master who is Shrotriyam and Brahmanishtha, who is learned in the scriptures and the Vedas, and is dedicated, has dedicated his life to the service of the Absolute. And his disciple must approach humbly. So therefore the metaphor is given, he has to hold firewood in his hands. So we don't, in the modern Vaishnav culture, we don't make that prescription that you want to take initiation, you have to bring a pile of firewood. Because our modern day acharyas are not busy performing fire sacrifices. That's from previous ages. It used to be the Brahmins and the Rishis. They sat in their ashrams, meditated, and performed fire sacrifices every day. So if someone wanted to come and become a disciple, he showed that he was ready to do menial service by arriving in the ashram with a bundle of firewood under his arm. the sign of showing, a way of showing that you're even if you're a king's son or a big Brahmin's son, you're willing to become a menial disciple, a humble disciple. That way, that's the explanation. That verse is used by almost all the Vedanta Sutra commentaries to explain this first sutra. Now, we should inquire what's the absolute truth. Now that we've seen that everything you can achieve in this world is petty, and that one has to go to a spiritual master and get transcendental knowledge. If we've realized that much, now it's time to start inquiring into what is the absolute truth. And the Upanishads will teach us what's the absolute truth. If what you want is liberation, that's where you should go. We also consider liberation important. Brahma-bhuta prasanatmana shochati na kakshati samak sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Krishna says if you want to enter into pure devotional service, you have to become liberated first. The person who's free from desire for material success, he's satisfied because he doesn't have any material ambitions. He's not agitated by material ambitions, so he's satisfied with whatever he has. He's not aspiring for some material success. And therefore, he's not lamenting. He's not hankering for things. And he's equal. He doesn't have any friends and enemies. So that person can begin pure devotional service. So that liberation, and that's required as a preliminary prerequisite for devotional service. So Karnam is not just speaking as an impersonalist, all this talk about liberation. It's also, we also have to first of all give up this material life, become liberated. Then we can seriously prosecute devotional service. Anyway, there's those who aren't that intelligent and they want to lord it over material nature. Prabhupada says in the purport, for those who want to lord it over material nature, material knowledge and science are available. And if somebody wants, he makes another statement, if somebody wants, he loves Krishna, but he wants material enjoyment, then he's in perplexity. That's an embarrassing situation. You actually have love of God, or at least you have a strong sentiment that you want to love God, but you've got material, you want to enjoy also the material world. That puts you in an embarrassing situation. That's how Kardama feels about itself. Anyway, Prabhupada explains, even for us who are embarrassed by our contradictory natures, Krishna gives us the opportunity to engage in practicing devotional service. This is the great benefit of sadhana bhakti. You don't have to be a paramahamsa to start it. You don't have to be free completely from material desires. You just have to have a strong desire to give your life to Krishna. And then all those obstacles of desire for material success, enjoyment, and for liberation, they'll gradually be purified away. They'll dissipate. And then, Prabhupada says, gradually we forget the hallucination. So this is what Kardam is discussing here. And that's the end of Kardam's prayers. Now, beginning with verse 22 is just one story. Maitreya Muni, who's narrating this story, the Vidur. So 22, I'll just read the verse. Vishiruvacha ityavalikam panutob janabas tamabhavashe vachasamitena suparna paksho parirochamana premas mitod vikshana vibramat bruhu. Translation, Maitreya resumed. Sincerely extolled in these words, Lord Vishnu, shining very beautifully on the shoulders of Garuda, replied with words as sweet as nectar. His eyebrows moved gracefully as he looked at the sage with a smile full of affection. So this is not just some mechanical interchange. You know, you pay your money and you get what you pay for. This is a very personal encounter. And we'll hear in a minute what Vishnu has to say to Tukarnam. Any comments here? Any questions? No? Yes, ma'am. If you didn't hear, that verse talked about carrying firewood. So that's how in ancient times a disciple should show that he's ready to do humble service. What nowadays is the sign? Prabhupada made it clear that, what he wants everybody to do is chant Hare Krishna and participate. If you want to join this ISKCON movement, ISKCON is about preaching. So show some interest in participating in the preaching activities of this movement. So if you want that, that's the equivalent, our equivalent of carrying firewood. You should pick up a bead bag and be ready to do some active service for the spreading of Krishna consciousness. That's how we demonstrate the Prabhupada and to whomever we want to accept as Prabhupada's representative that we're serious. That we want to be servants. You show that you want to be a servant by being ready to do some service. So in the ancient times, that meant, come with the firewood and get ready to sit down and we'll do some sacrifices. So same idea. Get your bead bag and get ready to do some service. Then we demonstrate it like that. Alright, let's look at Lord Vishnu's response to Kardama, starting at verse 23. He's talking in short verses, Anushtup, eight syllable lines. Anyway, the points made in Lord Vishnu's answer to Kardama, just a few verses, he explains to Kardama that he always looks after his devotees, he always fulfills their desires. And especially, he favors the Brahmins. And the Brahmins are always worshipable. These are the points that Vishnu is going to make. So verse 23. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Viditva Tava Chaityam Me Puraiva Samayojitat Yadartam Atma Niyamais Vayaivaham Samarchitaha. The Supreme Lord said, having come to know what was in your mind, I have already arranged for that, for which you have worshipped me well through your mental and sensory discipline. So, Vishnu, Supreme Person, he knew all of Eddie long time ago, before Kardama opened his mouth. Before he even started his meditation 10,000 years before. He knew beforehand. And he's already made all the arrangements to fulfill Kardama's desires. No problem for Krishna to make all arrangements. We feel frustrated that we have our ambitions and Krishna's not fulfilling them. It's not that he can't. It's not that he's ignorant of what we want or incapable of making the proper arrangements. Whatever obstacles we see, that's just the illusion of Maya. Material energy is set up to make us think that there's so many impossible obstacles. Krishna can, without even lifting a finger, remove all those obstacles and facilitate immediately facilitate the fulfillment of all our desires. He doesn't do that because he wants us first to surrender. No sense in just gratifying us until we give up our material attachments and misconceptions. When we develop a pure devotional attitude, then Krishna will fulfill all desires. But if he gives us what we want when we're still wanting the wrong thing, and wanting it the wrong way, then that won't do any good. So Krishna withholds. He's not like Lord Shiva. He doesn't just give his supplicants whatever they want just to get rid of them. He's called Ashutosh. So someone like Vikasura starts chopping off his own flesh, throwing it in the fire. And Shiva just comes and says, "What do you want? Can you stop this? What do you want? And I'll give it to you, whatever it is." So that's Ashutosh. Vishnu is not Ashutosh. He's more compassionate to his devotees. He doesn't give them necessarily what they want if they're too immature to ask for the right thing. But in Kardama's case, no problem. Don't worry, Kardama. I know what you wanted even before you even started asking for it. And I've already arranged for everything to be supplied. This is the Lord's intimate connection with his devotees. Even the devotees who are not completely perfect in their spiritual advancement. Kardama is still a sadhaka. He's still working toward perfection. But Vishnu is satisfied enough. He's ready to give him everything. Prabhupada explains in the purport, Krishna never disappoints his sincere devotees. But he doesn't give them what will be detrimental to their own service. He deals with each of his devotees individually. And he's careful not to give them anything that's going to hurt their obstruct or interfere or slow down their progress. So the principle is taught in the Isha Upanishad. Tena tyaktena bunji dhamma vidapasi svitana. God knows what he's doing. He gives each person what he needs and what's appropriate. So therefore, tena chaktena bunjita, just be satisfied with the quota that's given to you by God. Enjoy that. Magridakasit svitana. Don't be greedy for what someone else gets. We've been given our own share accordingly to what we need and what's good for us. This is a basic principle of the Vedic social system, Varnashram Dharma. That we each have different positions and we each have certain privileges and facilities and responsibilities. We should accept our own position and not try to change to someone else's position. And not be worried about, oh, he's got this and I don't. He's a big king and I'm a poor man. The poor man should be satisfied, the king should be satisfied, the Brahmin should be satisfied, everyone should be satisfied with his prescribed position in the Vedic system, in the Varnashram system. This is what people in the modern world can't tolerate. This idea of passivity, to accept your position, not to rebel, not to be dissatisfied, to be satisfied with whatever fate gives you. This is just, inhuman. This is, backward superstition. Greedy Brahmins trying to foster on the people some superstition to keep them subjugated. And that's why ISKCON has a difficult time selling the idea of Varnashram Dharma. We're afraid, our leadership is afraid that if we publicly announce that we're for Varnashram, that, we're promoting the caste system, the most backward superstition. We're afraid that people in the world won't tolerate this idea. But this is the scientific organization of human society. In the modern world is nothing but class struggle. In the stable social system, the Brahmins are not greedy. They live very simply, and they're happy to be the teachers, guides of society. And therefore they're trusted. The Kshatriyas are noble, even though they can be egotistical, they can be violent, and something to fear. Still, they're honorable, and they protect the citizens, and they obey the brahminical guidance. So therefore, they're respected and worshipped. And similarly, the Vaishyas, they're also doing their duty. They're productive, even if they're greedy. Still, they're providing all the produce, all the industry that's needed. And the Shudras are doing their work. So everybody's respected, and everybody's feels honorable. Even a Shudra is proud of being a Shudra. when the system is stable. But when things are out of control, when the Brahmins become corrupt and greedy, materialistic, when they fail to give proper guidance to the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas become unruly and weak, and then what happens? Class disorder and class struggle. And that historically we see it, especially in India. The Brahmins failed to do their duty and teach properly and guide properly. The Kshatriyas became quarrelsome among one another. India divided up into thousands of petty kingdoms. And there was no problem for foreigners to just march in, take over, beginning with Alexander the Great, 400 BC. There's chaos, there's struggle among the classes when people are not satisfied with their position. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that this Buddhist religion, going all the way back to 600 BC, was actually, there was political motivation behind the establishment of Buddhism, how it became popular. This is, I think, Tattva Vivek, one book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, explains. Because the Brahmins were so corrupt, the Kshatriyas didn't want to follow them anymore. So this Buddhist religion came around, and it was sponsored by certain kings. And the kings, these kings took the opportunity to promote Buddhism in order to get rid of the influence of the Brahmins, actually. So that the Kshatriyas could take over and ignore the Brahmins, they supported Buddhism. And Buddhism became prominent in India for 1,000 years. Later, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, the Vaishyas tried the same thing by promoting the Jain religion. So you see, even today, there's not many Jains left. A few thousand. But they have a few sannyasis who are very great renunciants. And then the rest of their congregation is all rich businessmen. They don't have anything else. They have very austere sannyasis and rich Vaishyas. Because the religion was promoted originally by the Vaishyas in order to establish Vaishya power. And what's the situation in the modern world? Is that we don't have any Brahmins left, any real Brahmins, or any real Kshatriyas. People who run the world mostly today are businessmen, money makers, either by legal or illegal means. And they're struggling with the Shudras. The Shudras are trying to take over. So there's a conflict between capitalism and socialism. It's a conflict between the Vaishyas and the Shudras. The Kshatriyas and the Brahmins, and the Brahmins and Kshatriyas are already out of the picture. And all that we remain with is a few Vaishyas and a mass of Shudras, each fighting among one another for power. That's the modern situation. And that's because of ignoring the principle of chena takena bunjita, being satisfied with your own position and cooperating with all the classes of the social order, working together for spiritual progress. Okay. Verse 24. So Vishnu continues.
Navai jatu mishaiva syat prajadyaksha mararhanam bhavad videshvatitaram mai sangri bitatmanam.
The Lord continued, my dear Rishi, O leader of living entities, for those who serve me in devotion by worshipping me, especially persons like you who have given up everything unto me, there is never any question of frustration. Vishnu calls Prajapati Kardama Prajadyaksha, leader of human society. Now usually the word leader, adyaksha means leader, usually we think of a Kshatriya, a political leader. But the Brahmins are actually, in a more real sense, the leaders of society. This is not understood in the modern world. Just like when at the end of World War II, Hitler was dead already, and they were just trying to divide up the world. And Roosevelt and what's his name in England there? Churchill, Stalin were meeting together, and a few others. They were the you know, the big men. And I think it was Roosevelt made a proposal that they should invite the Pope to join the meeting. Spiritual leader. And Stalin said, well, look, how many military divisions does the Pope have? Because, you know, what kind of leader is he? You know, he's got no army. Because the Popes used to have armies. How is a Brahmin considered a leader? That requires a higher spiritual, a higher understanding of the social order. It's not just political power, it's not just money power. Real power is the power of knowledge. When a Brahmin can speak the truth so honestly that everybody trusts his word, that's the higher power than can be wielded with money or with guns. But since we don't have hardly any such Brahmins in the world today, we just don't understand that. We forget about that. And therefore, money power and gun power, you know, are ruling the world. But when Brahmins become pure, when they become completely trustworthy, then they can change the world. They can take away that, you know, they can temper this, the unruly power of the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas. They can keep them under control by the strength of their word. So therefore, Kardama, Vishnu knows what he's talking about. He's calling Kardama the leader of human society. And he says that worshipping me is never wasted, never goes in vain. For surrendered worship. Because if someone's trying to play games with God, not honest with God, then God can also play games with him. But for a surrendered devotee, worship is never in vain. You know, if you want to cheat God, just do some business, okay, Krishna can also be a smart businessman. But if you approach him sincerely, not trying to just get something out of him, and you want to give him something, then there's no problem. Then that will never be frustrated. And he says, especially for surrendered devotees like you, he uses the words, Mai sangribhita atmanam. That means you've dedicated your whole existence to my pleasure. This basically, of course, that's the characteristic of a pure devotee, but also, in a more ordinary sense, is the qualification of a Brahmin. Like we said before, the lower classes, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, they're selfish. Vaishya is out to make a lot of money, maintain his family nicely. Shudra doesn't even care for his family, he's just out to fill his belly, enjoy his senses. Kshatriya and the Brahmins, they're selfless. But the Kshatriyas are, you know, ambitious and quarrelsome. The Brahmins, better than anyone else, or more than anyone else, are selfless. And they're actually dedicating their lives to the service of the Supreme. So Prabhupada explains in the purport, a devotee of the Lord is never frustrated, even if he has material desires. Even the Sakama doctors, the demigods and sages, they may encounter some difficulty because of their material desires, but ultimately their lives will be successful and they'll become pure devotees. Okay. I've got a few quotations here from the Vedic literatures, especially on the point that Brahmins are worshipful. Here Lord Vishnu is making the point that my devotees are glorious, especially the devotees who dedicate their whole lives to me. So Kardama is a Brahmin. Lord Vishnu is honoring him. And the Brahmins should be honored and respected by everyone. And there are many statements going all the way back to the original Vedas, making that point emphatically, that it's the duty of everybody in human society to have proper respect for the Brahmins, to support them, to listen to them, and to be respectful to them. It's not just some corrupt system that was created by the Brahmins for their own aggrandizement. This is the desire of the Supreme Person. He's expressing it here directly. Okay. Before we get into that, any comments? Yes. Yeah, the qualification is that they're surrendered to Krishna. Yeah. He's not talking about people who claim the medical statements. status because of their birth. Yeah. But still, just like in the story of King Nariga, some greedy Brahmin, you know, wouldn't let Nariga go, and you know, I've got to have that cow. I won't take another cow, or even 100,000 cows in exchange. So that silly Brahmin, Krishna wanted to respect. He was talking about even such a Brahmin. You know, if someone's a Brahmin, even just externally, still we have to show him respect externally. There's the example of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he went to Gaya to do Shraddha for his father. Gaya is famous for having a lot of greedy pandas, Brahmins there, who are always trying to get money from the tourists, from the pilgrims. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ran into them too. So in Chaitanya Bhagavad, it's explained how he handled them. You know, he didn't get into quarrels with them, he didn't insult them. He pleased them all with sweet words and didn't give them any money. Yes. Yeah, but he was so polite to them with his sweet words that they were satisfied. But even with these greedy Brahmins, the Supreme Lord, you know, insists that we have to show respect. Yes, sir? Yes. Well, it's just it's all one world. You know, the so-called aristocracy of Europe originally were kicked out of India, first sons of Yayati and then Parshuram, killed all the Kshatriyas, and some of them escaped to Europe and other places. So the ruling classes of Europe descend from actually Kshatriyas that escaped India various times, kicked out of India. So there's a connection there. But there never were any real Brahmins or Kshatriyas in these barbarian places like Europe. Now, they were ruling classes, but they were just, these were all aborigines in the forest, slaughtering one another, and the ones who were the best slaughterers, they became the aristocracy. There was never any real nobility in Europe. Barbarian culture from the start. They just learned how to dress themselves fancy and have a veneer of culture. But there always were barbarians. We're barbarians by our upbringing, to be honest. But it's coming originally from the same culture. It's just we're the fringe of Vedic culture. And the same history is there. There's the history of degradation. But European history, as far back as we can remember it, is degradation from the beginning. Never really was on a high level. We never had any real Brahmins or Kshatriyas. Okay. Here's some quotes, four or five of them. The first one goes about how the Brahmins are worshipable. And I think tomorrow I'll be able to hand out the first installment of these quotes, quotations printed out. This is from the Atharva Veda, original Vedic Samhita, original hymns of the Atharva Veda, the fourth Veda. This is the Veda of mystical magic, of magic to deal with enemies and obstacles. So this is from the fifth chapter, section 19 of the Atharva Veda.
Tadvairastram asravati navam Vinnam ivodakam brahmanam yatra himsanti tadrasvam hanti duchana.
This is with this intonations up down, low, high, and middle. The translation is that kingdom where a Brahmin is injured, mistreated. Misfortune leaks into that kingdom like water leaking into a broken boat. That kingdom is ruined by misfortune if a Brahmin is mistreated. Okay. And then we read one statement from the Shataputta Brahmana, which is the explanation of the mantras of the Yajurveda, second Veda. I couldn't locate the Sanskrit for this, I'll just read the translation. Somebody who reviles, who insults a Brahmin, the government should give him a fine of 100 coins. He has to pay 100 coins. And if you hit a Brahmin, if you strike a Brahmin, that person who hits a Brahmin, he will not behold the world of the forefathers for as many years as there are grains of dust which the blood of that Brahmin falls on. For every drop of blood of the Brahmin you shed, and for that many years you won't see your forefathers, the Pitraloka. Therefore, one should never insult a Brahmin, or certainly don't hit a Brahmin, or draw blood from a Brahmin. That's the greatest, so great is such a sin as the Shatapatra Brahmana. And then that's one of the Brahmanas, the Rig Veda Brahmana, called the Aitareya Brahmana, explanation of the Rig Veda, discusses, describes the ceremony for coronating a king. That's described in great detail in this and some of the other Brahmanas. Big ritual. Abhishek of a king, installing him on the throne. So the king has to make this vow, according to the Aitareya Brahmana, on the night before his coronation. He announces before all the people. Also, I don't have the Sanskrit for this one either. Oh, no, I do. Sanskrit is here. Yam cha ratrim ajayeham yam cha kretasmi tarubayam antareneshta purtam me lokam sukritam ayuk prajam vinjita yarite druhyeyam. So he makes an announcement in front of everybody. He's speaking to his priest, to the Purohita, the priest who's conducting the Abhishek. Because that's his personal priest. And he has a very important relationship with his priest. The priest is responsible for his spiritual welfare, the king's welfare and his prosperity. So he tells the priest on the night of the coronation, all the sacrifices and welfare work I have ever performed, the good destinations I have earned for the next life, my happiness, my span of life, and all my people, all of this good that I've earned from the night I was born up until the time of my death, you, talking to the priest, you will destroy all of it if I ever treat you as an opponent. If the king ever becomes unfriendly toward his priest, his whole life is ruined. Has to be fine. The Kshatriya has to also always be respectful to the Brahmins, otherwise he's ruined. One more. This is from Mahabharata, from Bhishma Dev's instructions to Yudhishthira in the Anushasana Parva, chapter 33. Adaivam daivatam kuryu daivatam chapya daivatam yadicheyu saraja syad yoneshta sa parabhavet. This is describing the power of the Brahmins. They can make a non-deity into a deity and a deity into a non-deity. That's the power of the Brahmins. That man can become a king who the Brahmins desire him to become. And he who